You're listening to the Electric Sheep Magazine podcast, and this episode is the second of two looking at the current state of gay cinema. Later, you'll hear our guest interviewer, Chris Patmore, from Films and Festivals magazine, talking to director Paul Morrison about his film Little Ashes, which features Twilight star Robert Pattinson as Salvador Dali, in a homoerotic retelling of Dali's relationship with the poet Federico Garcia Lorca. First, here's Electric Sheep magazine editor Virginie Selavy talking to the cult experimental filmmaker Monica Trout about her recent film Ghosted, which premiered at this year's London Lesbian and Gay Film Festival, and also about her career so far.
So you made a documentary about three Taiwanese women in 2004, Tiger Woman, Girl Wings. Yeah, is that where the idea of making another film in Taiwan came from?
Yeah, I actually made two documentaries in Taiwan and spent quite a bit of time there for researching, and I met a lot of people, a lot of filmmakers, and I was quite fascinated by Taiwanese culture in general, and especially with the Taiwanese film people, because they're very energetic and very enthusiastic about cinema culture. So I had a very good environment there. And one of the protagonists of Tiger Women Grow Wings is a very well-known writer in Taiwan. Her name is Li Ang, and she had written a novel about ghost stories, Taiwanese ghost stories. And through her, actually, I got the idea to make a narrative feature about incorporating ghost stories.
Okay, because you had been working in documentary mostly in the last few years, and you went back to fiction with Ghosted. Is that because of the subject matter, in order to deal with this ghost story idea?
Absolutely, because it's, you know, you can't really incorporate ghosts too well into real life stories, yeah. Right? So you do need narrative elements for that. Uh-huh.
Okay, and of course you use the element of the ghost story to talk about love.
Absolutely.
And how do you see that? How for you, what it was that you were, what was it that you were expressing about love through this ghost story?
I was quite interested in how Asian culture in general deals with death, because as a Westerner, especially as a German, who comes from a kind of repressed Protestant background, I thought it's a wonderful thing to do, to remember your loved ones through rituals and ceremonies. And that's a big thing in Taiwanese culture. You have 1 month of the year dedicated to the dead people. And that's the 7th month of the lunar calendar. And Taiwanese especially remember their dead family members or loved ones and friends by imagining that the gates of hell open for 4 weeks, and so the ghosts of the dead people come back and they visit the living, and the living give them food and drinks, and they communicate with them, and that is, and they burn paper money, and that's a wonderful thing of like kind of celebrating and memorizing and remembering your dead people. Whereas in our Western culture, especially with repressed Protestant culture, we have these ugly places called cemeteries where we have ugly stones and, you know, ugly flowers, and we are forced as children to go there like once a year to visit grandmother. So, but, you know, there's nothing, you know, there's just, it's has no atmosphere, and it's just sad and dark and empty. You know, so as a child, I could never wanted to go visit my dead grandmother. You know, it was nothing there I could remember and picture her. And so I really love these rituals in Taiwan, and I participated in some, and I thought this is a lovely thing to use in a movie.
Mm-hmm. And but for most of the film, you don't necessarily realize that it is a ghost story. And it seemed to me that you were using a series of doubles to explore the central relationship. Because, of course, you have Mei Li, who's a sort of double of Aileen, and in a way gradually replaces her. And you also have Judy, the video the artist, who is another sort of double. And then you have Aileen having a sort of substitute relationship with another German woman. And it seems that through those other lovers, they explore their own relationship.
Yeah, that's a very good point. What I also tried in this film is to mix German or even Anglo-Saxon tradition of the so-called doppelganger, which is a German word, but I think you know it in the English language as well, because that's another way for Westerners to deal with death, you have a projection of the dead person, and the dead person returns in a different way, in order to to cope with guilt or fear. So we have another person showing up there, and it has a similar source, but in both cultures it comes in different Gestalt. So it's a German word, in a different form, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. And it seems that it's only when Aileen is dead. In fact, she says that in the film. Sophie says that she only realised how much she missed him, how much he meant to her once she was dead. And it seems that it's through her sort of substitute presence in Mei Li that she finds out more about this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's something we don't learn in Western culture, how to cope with the loss of a loved one. Because there are so many different ways of how it materializes. I personally had a loss, a loved one died, and when it actually happened, I was totally numb, and I was in the middle of work, and I totally, I couldn't deal with it at all. And so it came back like a year or 2 years later that I really experienced and I really realized, wow, she's gone, and it's very strange. So I think that's something in our culture we haven't learned. Mm-hmm. Maybe this was, it's another topic. The American TV series 6 Feet Under was so successful because that was like the first cultural product which really try to deal with the subject in different ways, through humor and through black humor and through all kinds of different stories. So I think it's a very important subject we should explore more.
Mm-hmm. And compared to your first films, especially Seduction, which caused quite a lot of controversy, it seems that Ghost is a lot more subdued and maybe more mature, if you think that.
Well, I hope so. I'm a bit older by now, so.
You're obviously attracted to similar subject matter, but maybe in a different way, maybe in a more in a calmer way, less controversial way.
Yeah, and plus, times have changed too. When I started making films, films which dealt with sexuality, female sexuality, sadomasochism, it was fairly new. That was back in the early 80s, when especially women filmmakers would not touch the subject at all, especially not like sadomasochism. And lesbian sexuality in combination, that was really something new. And now we are like 25 years more advanced, and we have many more cultural products which do deal with all kinds of controversial subjects. So I guess, you do things for a certain time and then you just move on.
Yeah, okay. Do you see this as a good thing or a bad thing?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think it's a good thing because I do remember when we first showed Seduction, The Cruel Woman, in England, in Edinburgh at the festival, the audience was shocked and they didn't know how to talk about it. So I remember it very vividly. We had a packed auditorium, and then the lights went on when the film was finished, boom, and everybody left. They were like, they were totally frozen. They did not want to speak with us as filmmakers. They thought we were perverts or something.
Yeah, yeah. How do you feel you have contributed to this change in the representation of female sexuality at the cinema?
Well, I think it's lovely. It's almost part of a movement in a way. You know, there is quite a number of female filmmakers, lesbian and straight, bisexual filmmakers who really have worked on the subject, and we have quite a number of films made about this now, which I think contributed to a discourse in general that there's a language now to talk about it, and it's not like, you know, we are no longer perverts. We are just like regular people who just explore all kinds of different sexualities.
Who else do you feel was very influential in that movement?
Oh, I think especially like when I look from, you know, the German side, we have a retrospective of Ulrike Oettinger here this year at the festival. She's very influential with her work. And we have English filmmakers like Sally Potter, who's done quite a number of very interesting films. We have, in America, we have quite a number of filmmakers. Rose Tosh made some interesting lesbian features. There is so much out these days, you know. It's a big number of films.
Yeah. Gino Catherine Breillat?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, from the French side, absolutely. Yeah. She's very influential, especially love the film Amasseur.
Yes.
I was on a jury at the Berlin Film Festival, and I was fighting to give her an award for this one, and I did, so it was good. It was a few years back.
Yeah, it's an amazing film.
It's a great film.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorites.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But she still gets a lot of criticism.
I know, but that's... I think that's just like some, you know, just misogynist film critics or so.
And yeah.
It's mostly not about the film itself. It's just about, like, their ways of thinking, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's more to do with the person who criticizes it than the actual film.
Definitely. Mm. It seems to be that if a woman deals with this sort of subject matter, they get the reaction to that is a lot more violent than it would be if it was a man, which is quite shocking, really.
Yeah, and the weirdest thing is they're not even aware of it.
Yeah.
You know, it's some unconscious thing that's going on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's another film of yours that I thought was very interesting, which was Gender Noughts, where you looked at the issue of transgender. Why did you decide to do a documentary on that particular subject?
I was exposed to a lot of transgender people when I lived in New York. For example, a friend of mine I knew when she was a lesbian feminist decided to have a sex change. And since I knew her so well, I was just like, you know, I just saw the whole process she went through. And then I made a short film about him, you know, at the time. It was like a she who then had a male name, and her name was Max. She changed from Anita to Max. So, and then I made this film with Max, and he talks about his transformation. And later on, some more transgendered, transsexual people actually approached me to... they asked me whether I would portray them, which is lovely, because for a documentary filmmaker, the hardest thing is to build trust, you know, in order to really do a portrait. And in this case, they trusted me and they asked me because they had seen the short film I made with Max and thought it was a very good representation of a transgender person. So, and we had great fun doing this. We shot this in San Francisco. And it was a whole group of people who were all more or less friends, worked together. a very special situation, unlike in any other town on this planet, I think, until this very day, because the whole community was so supportive. And they did all kinds of interesting work together. They're more or less all artists, and so I thought it was a nice thing to do in order to show a positive image. Because, like, you probably know the movie Boys Don't Cry, right? So you have all kinds of really sad stories about transgender or transsexual people. And in this case, with my San Franciscan friends, you could tell it's possible to do this change, and it's a utopian thing which can come true, that people really can change their appearance so it matches much better with how they feel.
Yeah, yeah. Did you find out anything that surprised you while making the film?
Oh yeah, many different things. I mean, I was myself toying with the idea at one point, because...
To become a man?
Yeah, well, not, you never become like a... When you're a biological woman, you never become a man. You become like a, you know, a female to male transsexual. Mm-hmm. You know, you shift more to the other direction, but you cannot, never completely change. But I thought it would have helped me raising funds as a filmmaker, right? So, and I was really thinking, what is the good things, what's the bad things, and I really found out, I didn't want it badly enough. So I think you really have to want it very hard, because it's a difficult process, and it takes up a lot of time. It's physically challenging and dangerous as well, because we don't have enough data about how your body responds to sexual hormones. You know, like a female body, how does it respond to male sexual hormones? You don't have long-term data about this, so it's a very dangerous thing to do.
Quite a radical thing to do.
Oh yeah. Even if you don't have surgery, I mean, it's a big change. And then for myself, I really found out, yeah, I would have lots of advantages, but I don't want it so enough, you know, to go through it. And it takes a lot of time. For about like years, you really focus on yourself.
Yeah.
You know. So I didn't do it in the end.
In the people you met through this, did you find that it changed their identity, or it just helped them to be the person they thought they were?
Yeah, my feeling was, you saw the film, it's really different with each one, it's a different story. I found, like, with my friend Jordy Jones, I'm friends with all of them, so I do see them like every other year when I go to San Francisco. I find Jordy is much more stable as a male, you know, female to male transsexual, much happier, you know, much more, you know, feeling good about himself and much more one. The same with Texas Tomboy, it's also very good. Good choice, good thing he did. And then other people, you know, it really depends. Mm-hmm. Also depends what kind of relationships they're having, what is their work situation. But most of the Genonauts I've portrayed in this film are much, much happier now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you also worked as a performance artist. Did that influence your first films? There seems to be an interest in performance.
I never really worked as a performance artist. I did, like, well, just out of fun, you know, but I never considered myself a performance artist,
okay.
I think. Because I think my place is rightly so behind the camera, so I'm not really very exhibitionist.
Uh-huh.
I prefer to be, like, behind the camera, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I'm friends with lots of, like, performance artists. Like, Annie Sprinkle is one good friend I know for more than 20 years now. And I always feel close to them, and, like, Annie Sprinkle, I really admire her for her courage. Mm-hmm. You know, just recently, I helped her. I taped a show she did in a German museum together with her wife. She's married to a professor, Elizabeth, and the two of them were posing naked in a huge art in an art museum in Düsseldorf, and they did a kiss in for hours, you know, in this museum. It was fantastic, you know, and I taped them. It's cool, it's great, I, you know, but that would nothing I would really like to do myself, you know, but I'm happily supporting.
Yeah. Yeah, but it seems to be less of an aspect maybe in your more recent work.
Less of an aspect, you mean?
Less
performance.
Of a focus, yes, the performance aspect.
Yeah, not at the moment. Yeah, it's maybe in the beginning it was more of an interest, but not right now. But it might change, you know. A good thing is interest's always changing.
Uh-huh. And how has the perception of your films and of yourself changed in Germany? How are you seen now in Germany?
I made a documentary in Brazil some time ago, about 6 years ago or so. That was a so-called human rights documentary about children in the slums of Rio de Janeiro. And I think that shocked the German audiences. They did not expect that from me. It was that really a social activist human rights film. And they thought, oh my God, what is Monica Troy doing all of a sudden? But they did like the film. And now I'm going back to a lesbian theme. So I think by now they know that they don't know what to expect from me, what will be my next film about. And that's good. That gives me freedom to really, you know, do what I want to do. And I try to break out of these patterns. I don't want to be in any drawer, you know.
It seems that the focus has changed from more specifically sexuality, and love as well, and performance and sadomasochism, to those ideas, but more integrated in social, cultural, political background. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, it's really hard to close your eyes, especially as a filmmaker who travels quite a bit, and I meet a lot of people from different walks of life, from different cultures, and you're exposed to what's going on. And when I went to Brazil for the first time and people introduced me to Ivone Bezerra de Melo, the human rights activist, I was really quite impressed with this woman, and I thought her project was fantastic. And instead of, I could not work there as a social worker, it's really not what I'm good at, and I thought, oh, I can contribute to this project by making a film about it. And that was one of my most satisfying works I've ever done, because through the film a lot of people started supporting this project, and we founded a foundation which now gives money to this project on a regular basis every year. So the film actually helped to keep the project going. Mm-hmm. So that's great.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And in your work, you're not only direct, but very often you write the scripts, or at least you have some input, and you produce them as well through your own production company. Is that, could you imagine any other way of working, or is that the only way you can work?
Well, the older I get, the more I wish I would have a producer who would take that horrible work off my shoulders, because that is the part I really loathe to do. But, you know, the last film, Ghosty, was difficult to finance because it was a co-production between Taiwan and Germany, and it was the first of its kind. So there was a lot of tiring paperwork going on for a long time, and not enough money for, like, a producer to be part of it. And so I said, okay, I'll do it myself. I didn't really have a choice. But yeah, I wish I don't have to do it too many times.
Okay, that's an interesting response. Yeah. I thought you were going to say, oh, it was great finding this production company, you know, it gives me all this freedom.
Yeah, well, it does on one hand, so I don't have a boss who tells me what to do, and I don't have these arguments with producers, say, oh, we want you to shoot like 5 days less on this one, or you need blah, 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 we want you to have this cinematographer work on it, so I don't have that. But on the other hand, Well, it's, you know, very often it's late nights. I'm still sitting there preparing contracts before I send it to my lawyer because I, you know, I can't pay my lawyer the huge fees, so I pay half price because I pretty much, you know, do the first draft myself because we've learned to do these things by now. Yeah, but it's boring. I don't enjoy it.
Yeah. You know. Are you working on anything else at the moment?
Yeah, we probably do, as next we do an experimental feature on a very small budget, which gives us a lot of freedom with less people, like going back to the beginnings when we just had like 8 people, you know, on board.
Okay, what, do you know what the theme is going to be? Or?
I don't want to talk about it yet because there's all kinds of ideas. In May I would sit down and... put it all together.
Okay. So. Okay. Excellent. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, here's Chris Patmore's interview with director Paul Morrison about his film Little Ashes.
What attracted you to the story in the first place?
It was a very exciting story that was at the same time very intimate and personal, and also had a grand political sweep. You know, it was at a time of huge social ferment, artistic ferment, political change. So it's that combination of the personal and the intimate and the bigger moment in history.
Well, I guess they're quite a trio as well.
And a very engaging kind of bunch of characters, yeah. Mm. And it was a beautifully written screenplay.
The writer actually presented the screenplay to you, did she?
Yeah, she did. I mean, originally, you know, it was 200 pages, and then 3 years later it came back to me as 120 pages. And it was great, yeah. And I was interested from the beginning, yeah.
A lot of your movies seem to have a love theme through them. Is this something intentional?
Yeah, I think I like love stories, and I like... But also a lot of my movies are about a time of social change. So I think I like that combination of something personal with something bigger. Yeah.
Like your last movie about cricket and...
Yeah, but it was really about kind of the different migrant communities kind of arriving in London and the kind of huge... the beginning of multiculturalism, if you like, in Britain. Yeah.
With cricket being the binding.
Yeah, cricket being the sort of, you know, the MacGuffin.
Yeah.
If you like. Yeah.
So how did you come up with the cast for Little Ashes?
I must have seen every kind of rising young actor in Britain and in Spain over a period of time. And originally, Rob came in to read for Lorca, but he felt, and I was looking for a Lorca in the UK and a Dalí in Spain. I couldn't find a Dalí in Spain, and Rob was, you know, for me, you know, the perfect Dalí. You know, his combination of acute intelligence but also a kind of vulnerability that he needed for this story. You know, he needed to be someone that Lorca would fall in love with. So that combination worked perfectly, and found its expression. So I thought he was great for the part. And then Javier, the Spanish casting director, showed me all the up-and-coming young Spanish actors. Javier was just out of film school. His English wasn't very good. Just out of drama school. His English was not great, which was a bit scary, but he was absolutely wonderful, you know, in his reading of Lorca. And Matthew came aboard late, because somebody else had to pull out for one reason or another. And I wasn't at the casting, but I saw what he did on the casting tape, and I felt that he, you know, he had Bunuel's kind of solidity and strength, but also there were in the casting that he did, he showed me something that was he showed me his hurt, you know, which was really, really interesting. And his hurt at the closeness of it, that the two friends starting a relationship. So he came over. I was in Barcelona already, and he arrived, which was and that was kind of an interesting moment, because he had nothing like the physical presence that was there on tape, you know, in his own personal presence. But you know, having seen that he could do it on tape, I was kind of confident that he was going to do it on film. But a lot of the Spanish cast and crew got very frightened. They thought, this is not what Buñuel was like, you know.
It's called acting, isn't it?
It's called acting, exactly. Yeah.
So, Matthew, how did you get ready for the role of Buñuel?
Well, after overcoming all kinds of fears and demons, just from the fact that I don't look anything like Buñuel, I watched a lot of his films and read as much as I could in the short space of time that I had, but mainly it was the strength of the script that kind of pulled the character out for me. We had a week rehearsing beforehand, and we were basically, because I had the idea of what Buñuel was like in my head anyway, but that was sort of perfected and touched up during the rehearsal process, and it, you know, it came from various sources. You know, Paul, the Spanish cast, a lot of the crew, you know, they'd give me little sort of ideas of what Buñuel was like and his mannerisms and stuff. So yeah, it was gradually built up, and then when we started shooting, I think I kind of had it enough to pull out a decent sort of Buñuel.
And you had to disguise your northern accent.
Disguise my northern accent, yeah.
I think it's an advantage having a northern accent, you know, because you already got an accent that you can work from. Actually, you do look, you know, that you've got these dark shadows under your eyes there.
Yeah, I mean, it helped with it. Yeah, that's part of the preparation. I didn't sleep every night, partly through fear. The makeup did a decent job on me as well. They darkened me up a little bit, because I was pretty pasty as I am now. And then, I tried to get a tan as well while I was out there, but that backfired, because on one day of shooting, I had to rip my top off and do a fight have a fight, and I was just lobster red, so it was true Brit abroad style fight. So it was, you know, a little bit embarrassing,
but it's true, if they were all intellectuals, they would have been a little bit paler than the average.
They wouldn't go out in the sun if it was Spanish.
No, yeah.
Just the mad dogs and the Englishmen.
Yeah.
They shot it all on digital.
Yeah, which was a new departure for me. And I was scared of it at first, but we tested some different cameras, and how technical do you want to get?
As technical as you like. I quite like the technology.
Yeah. We shot it on Panasonic Vericam, which is usually a news gathering camera, but it actually has got good definition and a great film look, and it's half the weight of most of the HD cameras. So and you know, I wanted to shoot quite a bit handheld. I wanted not to be a kind of costume drama, but to feel contemporary and alive and to get close to these characters. And so it had to be a camera that that Adam could get on his shoulders easily enough, that would give us the look that we wanted, that would give us beauty when we wanted it, but also, you know, that he could use quite flexibly and fluidly, and it was a great choice. It really worked out. Actually, it was the special effects house, Molinaire, who suggested that we go down that route, and it was a great suggestion.
I was really surprised when I read the production notes that you shot it on digital, because it does really look very filmic. Do you think that's partly to do with the quality of the light in Spain? Did that help a lot?
I think it was the quality of Adam's lighting.
Right.
And also the camera itself, yeah, just the way the camera is engineered. So you don't have that, it hasn't got that, you know, it's got lots of kind of deep blacks, and it hasn't got that digital look where you see absolutely everything and it's all the same. It's somehow
where it ends up looking like television.
Yeah, yeah. So we were very happy with it. I was very happy with it.
Would you shoot on digital again? Or
yeah, I would. Yeah, I'm sold now.
Yeah,
yeah. You know, I'd like to shoot on film, but you know, given what you can do in post now as well, digital now kind of can match film.
Mm. So recently did an interview with Zsigmond, famous cinematographer.
Oh yeah, yeah, I know who you mean.
Yeah. He was saying the best thing to do is shoot on film and then use a digital intermediary.
Yeah, we did that in Wondrous Oblivion, and that is a good route to go as well, you know. But actually, the high def wasn't as you know, was so much better than I thought it was going to be.
Were any of the three lead characters, did they have an influence on you in your younger life when you were growing up?
Well, yeah, I mean, Buñuel was one of my cinematic heroes. You know, both the surrealism and you know, the anti-authority kind of, you know, because I grew up in the 60s, so, you know, well, you know, that was really important to me. So as a filmmaker, he had a big influence. Dali less so, and I really came to appreciate Dali more through making the movie, because I actually think that the paintings that he did under Lorca's influence, or through the influence of this relationship, and then kind of probably for the 8 or 10 years subsequently, were his best work and his most alive work. And I think he put his sexuality out there, you know, in all its kind of rawness and unformedness and all his confusion, sexual confusion, into his work in a way that was really brave and I think under-recognised, actually. You know, he's recognised for The Melting Clocks, and actually he was doing a lot more than that, you know, and putting his unconscious sort of feelings and desires and pain and kind of, you know, was very profound, I think.
But he's also a very technically proficient painter as well.
Yeah, yeah. But in the end, I think technical proficiency sort of took over, and it was more conceptual, and he was more out to shock for the sake of shocking. But at this time, I think he was doing something that was rawer, and actually more powerful.
It's similar to Picasso before he went cubist. A lot of his paintings then were similar, weren't they? Very beautifully executed.
Yeah. We're going back 20 years. Yeah. Well, Picasso also took risks in terms of kind of showing himself as a wicked lecher. But that was later, and there's an innocence about in Dali's work of this time, or that's in a way braver.
Do you think his innocence is what attracted him to Lorca then? He was actually in love with, but not really in a sexual way, but because you know, artists are quite expressive in lots of ways.
I think he heroised Lorca, you know. I mean, Lorca was a few years older than him, but you know, I think he was also physically attracted to Lorca, you know, and that was tough for him to deal with. That wasn't within his map of himself. Yeah.
Do you know, it might have affected why he went off with Gala in the end.
That's the story. Yeah. I mean, I think the film is deliberately ambiguous about Dali's sexuality, partly because we don't know and we can't know for sure, but also because I think he wasn't clear about his sexuality. And what I like about the film is that it presents a picture of sexuality that's more complex than gay or straight. That there are shades in between, if you like, you know. That actually, I think a lot of men experience at one time or another in their lives, you know, are able to be attracted to another man, you know, in spite of what they think about themselves. So I like that we don't take a simple position.
And how do you think the fans of Robert are going to take this film, if they can get into it?
Well, I mean, the
people... Was it 15, isn't it?
It's 15, yeah. Yeah. Well, the fans who found it so far, you know, and quite a few have come to the... You know, we've had a couple of screenings. One at the Belfast Film Festival and one here at the Lorca on Film Festival. And there were about 25-30% Lorca fans at both of them, and they really loved it, you know. So it's very exciting that Rob can help bring the film to a wider audience and also to a young audience, you know, to an audience who wouldn't have seen the film otherwise.
And it's also shown lots of people that he can really act as well.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. I think it's a terrific performance, you know, and a very difficult one. It's a very complex thing you have to do, kind of to move from being a vulnerable young man into someone who sort of embodies his mask is a tough feat as an actor, and I think he does it.
And how do you feel being sort of third fiddle in the...
I could use it, you know, because that's what, you know, Bunwell sort of felt a bit like that during the sort of deterioration of the trio and their relationship. So, you know, I can sort of put it into the film and into my performance. But no, I mean it always felt part of it, and that's what I liked about the film, and what I liked about the period that it shows, kind of young revolutionaries together, and it was, you know, the beginning of the shoot when we were all kind of shooting in the residencia. It was nice to be amongst, you know, other young actors and sort of portraying that feeling.
So did you get into the being a little bit hedonistic to?
Not really, no, we didn't really have time, to be honest, and I think because we were also totally committed to the film as well, we wanted to make sure we knew our stuff, to be honest, on paper, and, you know, and so we didn't really have time to sort of live like they may have lived. Would have been nice, I'm sure, but but not for Paul, imagine.
I like hearing now that they you went out and talked about the film. It's great.
I've heard of quite a few people say it's quite like a Merchant Ivory film as well.
I'm shocked and surprised because, you know, because we, that's not the way intent with which I shot it, you know.
Or are they, I just mean, they see the white suits and think, oh yeah.
I think, yeah, it's probably just the white suits, yeah, because a lot of it's shot handheld, you know, and it's shot, you know, and it's and they're very intense performances, so we were really trying to get away from that kind of costume drama,
but it's slightly inevitable because it is a period piece.
Yeah I guess so, yeah. And I'm struck myself by how beautiful some of it is, you know, and kind of poignant. So maybe Merchant Ivory do poignancy well, I don't know.
Not one of your favourite filmmakers, is it?
No, they're not the films I'm drawn to. Oh. No.
What sort of things do influence you?
Bunwell, Bergman.
Oh, right. Serious filmmakers.
Yeah, I mean, those are the filmmakers I grew up on.
For more info about the directors and films discussed in this podcast, please visit our website www.electricsheepmagazine.com, where you can also download the previous podcast that includes Virginie's interview with director Kenneth Anger. And there'll be a new episode of the Electric Sheep podcast online soon. Thanks for listening.